Hey guys, it's Brandon from the MacroOps Value Hive podcast. At MacroOps, our aim is simple. We want to make high risk-adjusted returns consistently, continuously learn while doing so, and have a lot of fun along the way. And in this regard, our record speaks for itself. This is partly why we have by far the highest retention rates of any investing service in the industry. Collective members tend to stay members for a long time because there really is nothing else like us. We offer differentiated research, theory, and education resources, plus a killer Slack community filled with some of the smartest operators from around the world. Our members are predominantly professionals, but we also have a high number of highly motivated retail investors and traders. The one thing we all share is a deep love for the game of investing and an unquenchable thirst to get better. If this sounds like you, then consider signing up and checking us out. You simply go to macro-ops.com/collective. That's macro-ops/collective. Before we dive into today's conversation, I want to talk to you about MIT Investment Management Company, also known as MITIMCO, the investment office of MIT. Each year, MITIMCO invests with a handful of new emerging managers who it believes can earn exceptional long-term returns in support of MIT's mission. In order to help the emerging manager community more broadly, they created emergingmanagers.org, a website for emerging manager stock pickers. For those looking to start a stock picking fund or those just looking to learn about how others have done it, I highly recommend this site. You'll find essays and interviews by successful emerging managers, service providers used by MIT's own fund managers, essays MITIMCO has written for emerging stock pickers, and more. MITIMCO also occasionally and opportunistically hires new members for their investment team. To view the job description, please visit mitimco.org/global-investor. That's mitimco.org/global-investor. The MITIMCO team spends their time learning about great businesses and investments, working with exceptional investors around the world in order to support generations of MIT innovators.
Cannabis is probably one of the most hated industries out there. I think it's up there with coal, maybe some parts of the energy complex, even some agricultures like soybeans and corn. And you even have Nick Radical, who was a former podcast guest, come out of the woodwork back onto Twitter pitching a cannabis stock. So you know if Nick Radical is pitching it, then you know that it's hated. And so I wanted to get Aaron Edelheit on the podcast again, just as kind of the resident cannabis expert. And through this whole kind of bombed out cycle we've been through in the space, a lot of people have left. A lot of tourists have left the industry and left that kind of sector. But Aaron's stayed in it. He's gone through it. And because of that, we get to share in his knowledge and his expertise. So Aaron, This is a long time coming to have you back on the podcast, and I'm excited to dive into cannabis.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Brandon. When was the last time we talked?
You know, that's a good question.
It was a while ago, right?
Yeah, let me see. I'm going to search it real quick. Okay, so we did a crash course on cannabis investing. Of course, Apple Podcasts doesn't have the date. Let me see.
It was probably like at least 12 months or 18 months ago.
It was in 2022.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So while you're searching that, I think it's really valuable to go back to 2022, which was just a very, very challenging time to be invested in anything speculative, anything risky, and especially cannabis. And yeah. I personally and professionally almost got destroyed. It's very valuable to go back there. Because, you know, cannabis stocks are doing better now, but it's really important to go back to 2022, at least, so people understand the U.S. cannabis industry, because it's federally illegal, none of these stocks trade on U.S. exchanges, and they trade either on secondary or tertiary Canadian exchanges or over the counter, and the liquidity is very low. For some of them, can be really low. The way I've thought about it is almost like investing in a developing country where you have shifting regulations, you have a gray market, and that liquidity can come and go. Another way I've looked at it is it's almost like investing in private equity with these weird trading stubs. And, you know, I was like a lot of people, I was worried about inflation. I was worried about what was going on and the speculation. But I said to myself, well, that's not going to affect me because I'm investing in the, you know, these companies that are growing, have cash flow. And the problem is that when the time goes out, liquidity goes out, when interest rates kind of soared and they shoot the most speculative stuff first. And it came at a critical time when we were expecting some government legislation, some changes to, you know, it's called safe banking that would have allowed easier access to banking and finance and possibly listing on exchanges. And so that kind of 1-2 punch of the lack of any regulatory movement with liquidity drying up really hit the sector. But then another thing hit, which was really a signal to me to change. And that's that this growth rate from some of the larger companies started to slow and then disappear. We can dive into exactly that. And it crushed almost every cannabis investor in 2022. And at the end of 2022, just to give you a sense of the sentiment out there, I had random people who weren't investors in my fund email me. And there's one in specific that I remember and kind of carry it with me as like a little chip on my shoulder, is this one guy who had looked into my fund, took time out of his day to email me and say, thank God I didn't invest in your fund. And I was like, oh, that's a great email to get.
Yeah.
Right at the exact time, you know, I have all my money in my funds, so I'm getting hit with all my other investors. And so it's important to like go back there, because the difference and what happened is lots of funds shut down. Lots of people, you mentioned, there are tourists who are like, oh, I have this as a portion of my portfolio. It's this interesting trade. A lot of people just said, ah, screw this, I'm out of here. This is just not what I signed up for. The reason I hung around is because I'm actually a true believer. And what I mean is not a true believer in any one company, but just in the massive opportunity that is in cannabis. And I wanted to go back there to explain like how was I able to hang around or stick around or somehow survive, is that I believe cannabis, the way I talk about that, I wrote a post about it, is I think it's the great replacement, and that people are consuming things to either relax, to alter their state of mind, to treat some malady, pain, or something else. And everything that you can consume is just a lot more toxic for you than cannabis. And cannabis replaces that. And people feel better. They have less side effects. And as a positive for society, it's just this huge. And I've written like a lot about the research in this. The way I got into it was from, I'm a kind of workaholic and driven in ways that I don't fully understand, but I am. And that can manifest itself in insomnia. And so like a low dose gummy has been life altering for me. You can only take like an Ambien for 2 weeks. If you take it longer, there's really bad side effects. Even if you take Ambien and it works, you wake up groggy. And then your body gets habituated, it stops working. And so you take that to like someone who has back pain, to, you know, You know, just think about alcohol. You know, 140,000 people die every year directly from alcohol. 4,000 kids, by the way.
Wow.
And there's just like, there's so many things. You know, we talk about fentanyl, 100,000 people dying. And the things that got me into believing in cannabis, because what I do is I'm not a day trader. I'm not very good at it. But I do deep dive research, and I have three young kids. I want the world to be a better place. And I'm not going to invest in anything I don't believe in. And some of the things, like whenever they legalize cannabis, drunk driving goes down, auto insurance premiums go down. But the one that really got me and still sticks with me is that workers' comp claims go down wherever cannabis is legalized. And then you're like, wait, what? And you just realize that people are consuming stuff to get themselves through the day. Yeah. And so that's kind of the underpinning, is that I think we're on this 20 or 30 or maybe even longer run of growth in cannabis adoption, because in general, it's just better for you, like opioids or any of the minor things you can do. And so what's happening is, while it's federally illegal, states after states are legalizing it, and they're finding that everything just gets a little bit better, and society does not collapse, and all of the things that we've been told, kind of reefer madness style, is just not correct. And you'll still see articles in the Wall Street Journal. I get emailed by it, by investors who are like, you know, trying to tie cannabis with psychosis. And the data is just very clear that there is no increase in psychosis. And most of the articles that they're writing about is like teenage use. And what I am in favor of is legalized, regulated over 21 usage. And the data again shows that wherever you legalize cannabis, teenage use does not increase. And so that the reason I mentioned that is what drove me to continue to go forward. And when everybody was leaving, I'm kind of one of these people that runs towards the fire. So yeah. One of the reasons I got into cannabis is that I love that there are very few institutional or professional investors, and no one really doing deep dive fundamental research. You have a bunch of retail and like more amateur investors who are trying, but when the few institutional investors, I had friends that basically just left, it means no one was doing work. Mm-hmm. And to me, that is the great opportunity. I remember, and my background was buying foreclosed homes, fixing them up and renting them out. I remember standing on the courthouse steps and looking around being like, where are all the institutional investors? But in 2011, when I started scaling, if you had priced the home that I had first bought in 2008 and 2009 at the bottom in 2011, I would have been down 50% easy.
Yeah.
And so that's what helped carry me through. And I wanted to just give that kind of backdrop. Now, I had a much, much better year last year. My cannabis fund was up, you know, 70%. But it's mainly from the destruction that happened in 2022, all these people leaving, giving up, which basically, and I still consider this, is that I quoted this in my letter, is that, you know, Charlie Munger telling the story about a fisherman, and like the number one rule of fishermen is to fish where the fish are. And the number two rule is not to forget number one. And I believe the fish are in the cannabis sector. And it's the roots, and I'll stop right here. The roots are in what happened in 2022 that kind of made it so hated, to have people think, you know, it just leave the sector and say there's no money, you cannot make money in this sector, I'm out.
There's so many different ways we can take this conversation, and I plan on exploring kind of each of these ways. But you mentioned early on in that intro that you're, I don't want to call, you know, a fanatic, but I would say like an ambassador for, you know, legalized cannabis consumption. I think that's fair to say. But yes, at the same time, you have this you know, obligation or this duty to invest, you know, your own money and then LP's money in a way that's responsible and in a way that is, you know, ensuring that you do all you can to manage downside risk and to invest in companies, that you think will succeed. And so how do you manage this? We'll call it like this secular brand ambassador fandom for the space while maintaining objectivity when you go to actually research these ideas.
Yeah, and no, so a great, this is, so I came into this sector when I first started and I had, now you have your thesis. Cannabis is gonna grow. There are a few investors doing research. There's opportunity, there's alpha. We have this broad trend that's gonna go on for quite a while. And so this is, there's, this is rich right here.
Yeah.
And now you get into the tactics. How do you invest in this? What companies do you choose? And so some of my initial investments, and this is what hit me in the summer of 2022, is I saw markets opening up and lines around the door for when New Jersey opened. Mm-hmm. But then not only did the stocks not, the stocks went down, but then when the results started coming in, I said, wait a minute, why aren't the lines translating into growth? Why is growth decelerating? Hmm. And my tactic, the way I expressed my view on the bullishness of cannabis, I have now come to believe was wrong. And that is, There are companies out there that are called multi-state operators, effectively known as MSOS or MSOs. MSOS is the index that actually owns a bunch of companies. But MSOs, as they're known. And what I thought is there was value in that vertical integration. There was value to size. There was value to these cash flows, and that they were going to be the leaders, and that the longer that it took, they would just consolidate their position in the industry. And when you first, the reason that so many of us were so bullish, we were looking at these companies growing at 30, 40, 50% and being like, oh my gosh, well, if I just take this to this state and this state and this state, you can just get a long path for growth and some eye-popping valuations. You know, future, like forward valuations, just super low. And my mistake was that while these new markets were opening up like a New Jersey, older markets were getting a lot more competitive and prices were plunging. Right. And it was, they were replacing what was happening in the older markets with the new markets. And that's only sustainable for so long. And then it was kind of this, what I also realized is so many of these companies were built on a kind of land rush model of, there's only so many licenses in this limited license market. And what you understand is, for people that don't know, is cannabis can't cross state lines. So you have states that have limited amount of licenses, and then you have states like California and Oregon that are like unlimited. And most of the MSOs were built on this limited license. You get in there, you grow, and then you blast it out. And the problem is they were built to exploit limited license markets. They were not built for operational excellence. And they were not built on unit level economics, where they didn't have to care that it cost them $1,500 or $2,000 a pound to grow indoor cannabis in Massachusetts, because indoor cannabis was $4,000 a pound or $3,000. Didn't matter. But it really matters when the price goes to $1,500 or $1,200.
Yep.
And then you've got a problem. And that realization. And then the other thing is, I didn't fully appreciate just the sheer complexity of what these companies had to manage. And that is, they were a farmer, they were a distributor, they ran retail stores, they were building brands, they ran kitchens and were manufacturing products. And they were doing this in what were effectively multiple different countries where you couldn't cross borders with wildly different regulatory rules. And it's like, you're just kind of just managing the sheer complexity. It's incredible. And then the strategy that works for retail may be very different than what works for cultivation, or what works for making a good gummy, or building a brand. And so that complexity, and that you need different strategic plans, different budgets, different capital requirements. How do you choose which state? And so I started shifting in the summer of 2022 and just basically being on the hunt for what are those companies that are focused and that are showing that they are competent and basically operational excellent in one thing. And the other thing that I realized is that cultivation, I realized that if you back up, society in general hasn't been growing cannabis at scale, has only been doing it for 7 years, maybe eight.
Yeah,
we've been growing and consuming cannabis for God knows how many years, hundreds, thousands of years, but we've never grown it like, you know, professionally or in a systematic, you know, industrial agriculture way. And you had so many companies, the Canadians did this the best, is they just incinerated billions of dollars, just literally having no idea how to grow cannabis. And then just realizing that there was this big myth of cannabis, that it was easy to grow weed. It's really easy if you want to grow crappy or mediocre weed, and it's wildly inconsistent. But that's not really how you build a supply chain. So I started really focusing on the cultivation side, in that you can't have an industry really grow without consistent, low cost, high quality cannabis. And then just realizing that there was a shortage, especially in the premium side, of people that could do it successfully. And so these are just some of the insights that kind of, that really drove me to kind of pivot. And it had me pivot to basically the smaller companies, because in a weird way, there is this view that economies of scale would work, but it only works if you have a competitive advantage or cost advantage, or you have something that can be replicated, right?
Yeah.
But a limited license is not one of those.
That's fascinating, because A, it takes humility to admit, you know, hey, I thought that this is the way that things were going to work, that this strategy is what was going to work in cannabis. Realize maybe that strategy was not working and that you were wrong, and then pivoting to something that makes more sense and that has, you know, longer staying power and allows you to invest in better businesses. And so with the lessons you've learned, you know, since call it the summer of 2022, or really all of 2022, how are you allocating capital now in the, call it, cannabis value chain? You've mentioned cultivation, you've mentioned brands. So how do you, like, what's the process now for trying to find ideas across that space?
I mean, it's a great question. And so what I focused on, and I think I found two really great cultivators that are a show, and this is part of when there isn't a lot of research being done, when there isn't a lot of due diligence, and there aren't a lot of professional investors who in any other industry, and I've been reading some of your stuff you've been writing about tin and the commodities. So Brandon, if you went into any of those industries, you would be like, okay, how do I determine who's a good management team or what's a good company? Okay, I wanna look, what's your strategy? What's your focus? Now, can you break out? What's the cost to take the mineral out of the ground? What can you sell it for? You know, how much CapEx do you have to spend? And then like, what's the unit level economics? What happens if the price of copper goes here? Where's the historical band of copper price? These are all basic questions, right? And then you just want to understand, does the management team, have they done it before? You know, things like that. And you basically have had almost no one talk about, even now, in most analyst reports, no one will talk about, well, it costs this leading company this to grow cannabis. And they sell it for this in their stores.
Right.
Or they sell it in this market, this is the price, and it sells here. Maybe you'll, there might be like five institutional quality investors out there who do this kind of work, but it's not many. And people are outbidding without really knowing what the unit level economics are. And so where I have been focused is the companies that just, one, disclose that. And the reason they disclose it is because that's part of their strategy. And so one of these companies is, you know, it's just showing you the opportunity is, I did a bunch of research on Glasshouse Brands. It's been one of my investments from the beginning. It's really helped me outperform.
You still own it?
Yeah, I still own it. And I had a thesis that what they were trying to do is for the first time really grow good quality. I wouldn't say the greatest quality, but good, strong quality, consistent cannabis at scale and at a cost no one could hit. And I live in Santa Barbara, so I know what the weather's like. And one of the things that's absurd about the cannabis industry is most of the weed is grown indoors. And that should be the one telling point of like, wait a minute, I thought cannabis was, you know, and you'll talk to even Wall Street. This is, I go back to the big myth of cannabis is that growing the flower that you smoke, it's like growing an apple without its skin. And so what that means is it's incredibly susceptible to mold, pests, disease, temperature. And so it's just remarkable that there's this whole view from people who are not in the space, or even, I think it's less now in the space, but it used to be that you can, you know, cultivation, you know, you just put up a facility, it's super easy. And then there are stories like one of the companies in the sector, Air Wellness, literally lost power for 4 hours in Florida and lost 3 months of cannabis
production. Oh.
So it's just like, just to tell you, just like the conditions need to be perfect. And so my thesis was, well, this is, I feel very lucky to live here. It's like God's gift to the environment. You know, it's sunny, like 320 days of the year where they have their facility. It's like average temperature is 72 degrees. You don't need a lot of power. You can harness the weather. And they had a state-of-the-art greenhouse. And then what I did is just basic due diligence. I talked to other producers, other private companies out there who have greenhouses, who compete with them or work with Glasshouse. And I said, like, what is the difference between this and this? And I literally had one of the leading cultivators list out for me how he wished he had their facility in Camarillo and explain to me in detail, like, how they could have a lower cost structure than he could, no matter how hard. And this was a guy who took pride in what he did. And he actually thought like, oh, I think I could even do it better if I had that Ferrari. He called it a Ferrari. And so I wrote like a whole, you know, research report about this. And I'm like, hey, I think they have a cost competitive advantage. I'm hearing this from, you know, competitors. And then they started reporting and showing their numbers despite California cannabis pricing having plunged. And the reaction from the investment community, at least initially, was just crickets. And some people being like, I don't believe there's any difference. And like, no one really caring. And to me, it's like, I follow my curiosity. And it was just really remarkable in the beginning of 2023, where you had a publicly traded company that unfortunately for them, it was called Lowell Farms, they had a greenhouse in Monterey County. And it was remarkable. It has been remarkable watching Glasshouse put up a 61% cultivation gross margin while a company in the that supposedly is a greenhouse producer announced negative gross margins. And this is with pricing down 50%. And it was just like, and what's been so interesting to me, and this is the opportunity in cannabis, is like, that's an area for exploration, right? That's like, hey, how is this company doing this? This is something really interesting. They have a cost competitive advantage. And then just, it's just really fascinating. Now the stock has very, I was just talking to an investor earlier today, and we were just remarking how different it was when you had people saying there is nothing, why would you be in cultivation? Why would you be in California? This is awful. I don't want to invest. And people freaking out about how terrible California was, farms going out of business left and right. And, Glasshouse, I think it bottomed at like $1.93. Now it's near $7, but it's like, no one was really asking the question. It was like, hey, look at the unit level economics. No one else can make money at these pricing. These prices are below the marginal cost of production. It's like any other mineral. Like, yeah, can oil go to negative dollars per barrel? Yeah. And will Saudi Arabia lose money? Yeah. How long can it stay there? And so it's that kind of questions that kind of drew me into Glasshouse, and now they're expanding into they're expanding their greenhouse because they're only using 20%. Now they're using 40% of it. They have this cost advantage they're like leaning into. And then the other company that I was that I want to just bring up is my largest holding. It looks like a very insignificant tiny microcap. But a lot of companies that were very successful used to be small and insignificant. But if you're doing something unique and special and you can replicate it, then you have the a very large chance of basically getting much bigger. And so my largest investment is a small company called Grown Rogue. And again, I remember my thesis is I was like, oh man, I'm wrong. There isn't a shortage of limited licenses. There's actually a shortage of operational excellence. And so I got introduced from a fellow investor. He's like, you got to look at these guys. And they were the large investors. And I credit the Bengal Capital guys for this introduction because Grown Rogue was the best performing cannabis stock last year. And the reason is they are the number one cultivator, the number one flower brand in Oregon. Why that's important is Oregon is, just like California, one of the most competitive markets, some of the lowest cannabis flower pricing. And if you don't make great flower, it's just not going to sell because you're not only competing against the legal market, you're competing against the illicit or gray market and the legacy. Yeah. And Oregon has a long history of that. But most importantly, is an $800 indoor flower. They were free cash flow positive. And no other company that I had found was doing that. But more importantly, when I found them, they had gone from Oregon to Michigan. And for $4 million, became a top five indoor flower brand in Michigan. And I'm reading all these horror stories in Michigan of the prices collapsing in Michigan. And Grown Rogue, they don't care. They didn't care that prices came from 3,000 to 1,000.
Yeah.
1,000 was higher than 800. And so they were even more free cash flow positive. I visited the company. I did a bunch of due diligence. I talked to the CEO. They needed capital because they wanted to go east. And the most important thing that Grown Rogue does is they do one thing, cultivation. And they do small craft cultivation because they actually believe in the segment of the market that they're going after. They don't want to be the largest. They're going for the best possible cannabis at the lowest price, but they're turning the genetics as quickly as possible. Another interesting facet of the cannabis industry that I found is it's very much a fast fashion industry in that consumers, the power users, want that latest genetics. They want change. They want different experiences. They care about the color of the flower. You know, again, that makes it different than just a commodity market is the color purple sells for a higher price than just green now, though that may change. And so they realized early on, they don't want to do everything. They wanted to focus on one thing. And they also realized something very unique. And it makes it a very different value proposition than Glasshouse. Glasshouse is like good quality. Think of it like Budweiser. Just blasting it out, right? And no one can touch their cost. But what Grown Rogue can do, Glasshouse has 5.5 million square feet that they can eventually cultivate. Grown Rogue is looking to build 50,000 square foot facilities with like 20,000 square feet of bench space and turn the genetics. And scale is actually not your friend when you're trying to keep up with like the latest genetics or fashion. It's harder to sift and to pivot and to the larger you are. And so what they realized is there was this perfect kind of circle where they could produce for $550 a pound for high quality indoor flower, and they could bring everything they learned from Oregon to new markets. Well, now in March, they're going into New Jersey, where prices are $3,000, $3,500, $4,000 a pound. And so what was remarkable to me is finding a company, and this is, again, not one analyst. There is not one analyst report on Grown Rogue. And they have some of the highest margins in the industry in cultivation in Oregon and Michigan with some of the lowest pricing. In any other sector, Brandon, if you and I were looking, we would be like, how are they doing this? This is different. 34% EBITDA margins, where people have left, the larger companies have left the markets that they're in, and now they're heading to even the easiest markets. And so for me, what I've just done is just followed my curiosity and asked, I don't think what I'm doing is rocket science, just asking like, hey, what are you doing? How are you achieving that? Can you repeat it? And now I see this small company, but they have a box that they can reproduce. They can go ahead and say, I'm going to enter this state for this amount of money, and I can produce at $550 a pound. The price is above that. I only need to capture this percentage of the market. I can map out how many states they want to be in. I can model different pricing. And I get this, you know, at the time, you know, and even now, I think this is a company headed to $50 to $100 million in EBITDA, where about 60% of it translates to free cash flow. And the fully diluted enterprise value is like 70, 75 million, and no one covers it. I think they're the best indoor cultivator in the country in terms of what an investor would look for.
How do you measure these companies on a like-for-like basis? And the reason I ask that is because Pat Connolly on Twitter, he had a question about manufacturing capacity. And I like the idea of maybe analyzing these things on like a EBITDA or free cash flow per square foot of cultivation space as a way to get a gauge on like who's the most efficient with their capacity.
I actually think that can be a mistake. I think this is where the mistake lies, because I want, if you go back, this is just the lens I'm looking at. Maybe I could be looking at it the wrong way. Okay. But the problem of cannabis, and this is the problem of the entire industry, is there really should be interstate commerce. This is actually my Super Bowl case on Glasshouse, is that, you know, if they could max out their facility, no one could touch their cogs. And I think the company could earn $2 or $3 a share of free cash flow a year. It's that. I mean, you could explode. But the problem is cannabis can't cross state lines.
Yeah.
And you have wildly different regulatory structures. The problem, and I fell into the same boat, is you cannot value a New Jersey cash flow the same as an Oregon cash flow. Because the New Jersey people were valuing Massachusetts at huge multiples. And guess what? Those multiples don't exist because that cash flow doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Because prices came from $4,000 a pound to $1,000, $1,200 a pound. And stores, when it was the only state that was, and there were a bunch of states where it wasn't prohibited, you had border stores doing $50 to $100 million a year in revenue. And so companies are just printing money. Yeah. That's not sustainable. That's like kind of a short-term excess cash flow that you're earning. And so this is where I feel very, very different than most cannabis investors that are investing, is that they're looking at that. And to be honest, I don't know where pricing, I can make an assumption that pricing in general for like indoor flower will be somewhere between $1,200 in a band. Could it go to $1,900? Yes. Could it go to $2,000 in shortages? Yes. But you cannot value the cash flow in the limited license markets that are slowly but surely getting more competitive the same way as elsewhere. So it is not a good idea to judge. To me, and this is the problem with most of the companies, is if you went to any of the large companies and you say, tell me your cost of production of cannabis in each state, they will 1,000% not tell you, because it would be frightening. It would be frightening. It would frighten most people.
Okay, so you
and
look
I,
at-
I know
at
the- there are companies that are very good in one state that have gone to other states and literally imploded. And I know of one company that just basically stopped in one state, and it was costing them $2,000 a pound to grow mediocre cannabis, and they just shut it down.
Wow. So you take something like a Grown Rogue, and they brand themselves, and I'm looking at their corporate presentation, their last presentation. So they brand themselves as kind of this craft sweet spot. And so they've got this one slide, and you know, obviously this is audio, but they've got this one slide where it's low end bulk on the far left, which is very large, low quality, sun grown in greenhouse. That's on the far left of the spectrum. And then they've got ultra premium on the far right, which is small specialty production. And Grown Rogue says that their sweet spot is right sized, efficient facilities, modest CapEx, moderate volumes, and high margins. And so when I hear craft, my immediate thought is, oh, this is like one of those craft breweries or those craft beers that try to have
this niche.
That's exactly
right.
Okay.
To me, it's like a Grown Rogue. It's like a Boston beer. They're trying to be a Boston beer. They don't want to be the largest. They think there is this really sweet spot in the market they can meet. And that's why it's really important. The problem that I feel like a lot of companies in cannabis, and they've kind of been forced in this by some regulations, they have to kind of be all things to all people.
Yeah.
And then I see a lot of the larger, you know, some one company in particular, I'm not going to name, I think of it as spaghetti on a wall. They're literally buying this, going that, doing everything. And it's like really important if you're going to be an investor, like, what does this company want to be? What's their strategy? Does it make sense?
Yeah.
To me, what Grown Rogue is trying to do makes sense. And they're showing it. It's not only that, it not only makes sense, they've proven it. Kind of like the same way that Glasshouse has been proving it. But like Grown Rogue is like, if you can produce 34% EBITDA margins in the most competitive markets in the side of the business that everyone's exiting, you know, what happens when you go to less competitive markets? That's really compelling to me.
And so if you roll, if you play this out over the next 3 to 5 years, my instinct is that if someone like Grown Rogue is making 30, 40% margins, other craft competitors are going to come in and try to say, oh, we have a great flower as well. We're efficient. Like, we're this niche. And so in a way, it kind of gets to the argument of how much, not CapEx per se, but how much investment in whether it's marketing or advertising do these companies need on a run rate basis to stay top of mind for consumers? Because that's the other thing.
This goes to the key is that I'd have to check. I don't think Grown Rogue's spending very much on marketing. Okay. So it's like, this is literally the consumers know what to expect and they get. But this goes back to my thesis that the big myth in cannabis is that cultivation is easy. And it turns out, and you can just look at the experience of the industry, whether in Canada or US, and you find very quickly that it is not. There are some people that actually believe that cultivation at scale is almost impossible. I'm not one of those people. I just believe it hasn't been done properly. It is both an art and a science. And so for you to get into cultivation, but this is also, and I have you to credit for this, but I have you. You're the one that turned me on to the capital returns book, right?
Thank you.
And so you turned me on. And when I was getting kicked in the nuts repeatedly, I'm looking at everybody leave the industry and capital go to zero.
Yeah.
And it hasn't changed very much. Where is this capital that would come in to build cultivation for something that's extremely difficult? I don't see it. I think it would be very different if literally companies are raising hundreds of millions of dollars, people are building. We'd be having a different conversation.
Yep.
But so many people have just asked Constellation Brands or British Tobacco, how have their cannabis investments done? They've incinerated billions of dollars trying to invest in Canadian cannabis companies. How has Canopy Growth been doing? Or Tilray? Or any of those companies up there? And so I think we are far, far away from anyone being like, you know what? I think it's a great idea to cultivate cannabis. And I tell you what you have to compete with. You have to compete with OB Strickler, the CEO of Grown Rogue, who his office is the shittiest CEO's office I've ever been in. His office is in the grow house. There are no doors. It's an open air room. You are not going to beat him on cost. You are not going to beat him on his commitment to the quality of the flower. And you're not easily going to be able to replicate how exactly he has designed the perfect facility with the number of people, the culture, and the art and science of how to turn those genetics to be able to compete with them.
Yeah. No, I mean, look, that makes
sense. And that's where I come back to. Look, if you suddenly got rescheduling, descheduling, we have some mania on cannabis, everyone's making tons of money, investors are like, woohoo, this is the easiest thing in the world.
Yeah.
Companies, you know, we might be having a very different conversation. I'm still digging myself out of the hole that I dug, almost trying to bury and kill myself. So that's where I am. I still look around and we've had a nice little rally. I'm looking around and being, and you talk to most cannabis investors that are still in the space, and they're like, everyone's just waiting for the rug to be pulled again.
Yeah, I mean, when you have Tilray go from $300 a share to $1.91, that'll scare some people. That'll scare some people. But you mentioned the rescheduling.
How about this? Air Wellness at one time. I personally invested it at $4.
Yep.
It went to 35 and then went to 60 cents.
And now it's can't over even three.
Find it. Now it's over three.
Okay. Let me look at it here.
That is the experience for most cannabis companies.
Yeah. Yeah. It was, looks like it IPO'd at like $20, went up to 37.
No, 40. It was actually, that's probably not in 2020, you could invest in it at $4 or $5.
So it's probably some sort of,
and then it ran to 35. Yeah. And then it ran to 30. And so, like, this is the experience. So we are very, very far from, in my view, having to worry. I still see, you know, this industry has very, very little capital available, yeah, if any. And the only real investors that I see out there are, you have some survivors, and then you have, I guess investors, but they're more on the debt side. They're more of like, I'll lend you money on your real estate. I'm going to earn excess alpha, and I'm going to, clip at 20 or 25% interest rates because you can't access the capital markets.
Right. So a question I have for you, and I feel like I know partially the answer, but I want to kind of end the conversation around regulation and the rescheduling, which is like probably the single biggest catalyst in this entire space. And it's been the biggest catalyst, you know, for a couple of years. And so You mentioned capital returns, and part of the beauty of, you know, investing in bombed out sectors is that there's no capital available. It's hated. No one wants to touch it. So you can find bargains. But if rescheduling happens and cannabis, you know, switches from something that's illegal to something that's legal, safe banking gets in place, all of a sudden, all of these cannabis companies have access to decent capital, decent cost of capital. Like, things are going to change, and maybe you have more capital flooding in, lower prices, maybe there's more races to the bottom. How does that impact the way that you A, value companies, and then B, model them out over the next 3 to 5 years?
So that's a good question. And you have to ask me about beverages to end the conversation. You can't end it here. Okay.
Okay. Yeah. That's
so just to FYI. Okay. So, we'll go down a rabbit hole with that. But this is the way I think about. I think you're going to get rescheduling. And I think there are people that are more skilled than me that are playing a trade. And that's not the game that I'm playing. I think there are people who are in, you know, investors, traders, et cetera, that can move in and out of stocks and can earn possibly really great returns playing kind of the big trade of what happens when capital enters the industry and can invest, and what will multiples do? That's not the game I'm playing. The game I'm playing is I'm a really, really big believer in cannabis. I think we have, I mean, look at the, like, if you had developed a thesis, and I had a friend that did this, you developed a thesis around the cloud and cloud adoption. Has that trend changed in any material way in the last 10 or 15 years? No. And so to me, I think any rescheduling or federal reform, that's the beginning. I think that we've been playing in a messy spring training, and that the first pitch of the first game of the season it'll be like if the federal government DEA comes out and says rescheduling, that'll be the equivalent of the umpire saying play ball.
Yeah.
And so I think we're at the very, very beginning of this. And the game I'm playing is, well, my companies are in a very clear trajectory. I believe they have sustainable competitive advantages, and they're doing things that are very focused, and they can continue to grow. I've mentioned on the cultivation, I've made some other investments in other places in some private companies. There's one that's like an edible and pre-roll manufacturer where called Garden Society, where the CEO is, you know, a chemical engineer and worked for the German conglomerate Henkel for 10 years as a lean manufacturing, Six Sigma black belt expert. And so it's like, to me, these companies are going to continue to grow. And my thesis also that the West Coast companies that have been competing in the most difficult environments, when they head east, it's just, it's going to be much, much easier for them. That's where I'm focused on. And I just want to continue to make sure that my thesis is right, that the companies are allocating capital the best they can, and that I'm not wrong. And the rescheduling and the federal reform will all take care of it, take care of itself. But that being said, my expectation is by Q1, by the end of this quarter, we're going to get an interim ruling from the DEA that'll be like Schedule 3.
Got it.
That's my expectation. But that's not how I'm not trading that. I am, you know, I've made my bets.
Do you hedge your long positions by shorting MSOS?
No, I could not imagine. I was thinking about this a lot. There are companies where I'm like, oh man, that company's a mess. That company's burning cash. That company is whatever. There are some larger companies where I'm like, Brandon, if you gave me money for free, I wouldn't invest in that. I could think of nothing dumber, in my opinion, than shorting any of these companies, because the chances of one of them, I mean, just look what's happened in the past couple of years and still happens in a variety of times. You just have this random company suddenly go up 1,000%. It's like, why would I do that to myself?
Yeah.
And to me, it's like, I'm also, the other thing I didn't mention, the shift that I made in 2022, I started moving up the capital structure, investing in convertible debt, senior secured notes. And I have a yield in my fund that is just wonderful. Like every quarter I'm getting checks. The other thing I'm very grateful for is that my investors have been truly awesome. When anyone wants to come into my fund, or I tell them like, look, this fund could be down, you could be down 20 or 40% in a month. Like, these things are very illiquid. Please don't give me any money you need anytime soon, or that you'll be scared out of. And that's been really helpful. So I don't feel the need to hedge. And not only that, I just think it's about as risky as you can get, because you just can't predict. These things are so illiquid, you can't predict. And I personally think you're playing with fire. And the other thing is, I don't necessarily want to short any companies in an industry I'm so bullish on.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's fair. And so before we
get into beverages, because I know you want to talk about that, if we were to run this podcast back in another 2 years, and for whatever reason, these stocks didn't work, and the industry continued to face pressure, continued to lose money, what would be the reasons for that? And where in your current thesis hypothesis would you most likely be wrong?
It's a great question. Where I would say is that literally regulatory reform did not happen. I think that you would have regulatory reform not only not happen, but you'd have no more states go adult use, that you would see, again, more price pressure. You would not have any movement on interstate commerce, like literally zero movement. And probably an overall challenging investment market with higher interest rates and, you know, limited capital availability. That might actually help you, the limited capital availability, but I could see a place where you just continue to have distressed valuations where it's just, and you get no relief on the federal front. That is a very clear risk. And that's one of the reasons I moved up the capital structure. So I literally am getting paid while I wait. Because yeah. One of the risks of this industry is that we're governed by very old people that have, unfortunately, very antiquated opinions. And cannabis really isn't one of these hot button issues that really drives voters. The reason it's different now and the reason I've been so bullish on rescheduling is because President Biden has a problem. He's going to be the oldest person to ever, the oldest person to ever run for president. And if you want to get people to vote for you and to not be viewed as senile, and to be with it, how could you signal that? And to me, there's only one real issue that doesn't hurt you politically, that helps you, that is super popular, that shows like, hey, you're with it. And that's cannabis. And that's why I think you're going to get it. But I think the number one thing would be the federal reform. And then the other is that whenever companies are expanding, there's always a risk of execution misstep.
Yeah.
Now, I think that's been de-risked because they've shown it, but look, anything can happen.
This has been such a good conversation. I feel like I've learned so much, even from the last 2 years. Just getting your insights.
Yeah, you learned from my pain.
I did. I took something from Charlie Munger.
My round trip.
Yeah. I mean, Charlie Munger said it, right? If you can learn from other people's mistakes, that's better than you making them yourself.
My pleasure, Brandon. My pleasure.
No, look, I think there's something really special about you as an investor. Just for coming on a podcast like this, coming on a public forum and just being comfortable with admitting your mistakes and where you went wrong and maybe what you got wrong. There's a lot of investors that just wouldn't do it. They wouldn't take the interview. They wouldn't take a podcast. They wouldn't want to talk about what they got wrong. And I really appreciate the fact that you're so honest and open about it. And I think that's what's going to make you succeed in this space, whether it's cannabis. I mean, you were up here pitching Nintendo, and now Nintendo's finally getting its day in the sun. And
yes, it really is.
It's not all waltzes here for you.
Enjoy that. No.
I mean, the market god.
Go ahead.
What I was going to tell you is that.
I'm really just following my curiosity. My favorite part, and I get the sense from you, the same thing of why you do this podcast, why you write, you're just kind of following your curiosity. I am so endlessly fascinated by peeling back the layers of the cannabis industry. It's so interesting to me. And not only that, it's like, I think cannabis is one of the true disruptive things happening in American society today. And it's really fascinating to me. And if there's anything that baffles me, it's that why so few other investors are interested in what's coming. And so I teased you before about the beverages, but what's going on in hemp beverages right now is so crazy. And awesome and amazing, and no one's writing about it. No one's researching it. And it's frankly just, I'm literally launching a fund that it's going to invest in hemp beverages. And the fact that there are no other funds like shocks me. And I'll just give you a stat.
Yeah.
I believe 15% of Minnesota liquor store sales right now are hemp THC beverages. Does that,
wow.
Do you know what the size of the US alcohol market is?
I don't know, but it's got to be hundreds of billions. Maybe I'm wrong.
It's $260 billion a year in revenue.
Yeah. Yep.
And so I told you it's 15%, but that's not actually what got me interested in at the end of October. I read that it was 10%, and I said to myself, that can't be right. That's too large a number. And it turns out not only was it correct, and I talked to the liquor store chains, breweries, dispensaries, brands, it's growing. And it is THC, 5 milligram, 2 milligram, 10 milligram cans, and now it is spreading like wildfire throughout the country.
Yeah.
I think low-dose beverages, I think, are the killer app. I think it's the greatest thing ever to happen to the cannabis industry, because low-dose beverages are socially acceptable in a way that the subculture of cannabis is not in many conservative places.
Do you think you could see another Celsius come out of the low-dose cannabis drink space?
Oh, 100%. 100%.
Yeah.
Absolutely. That's why I'm racing, because beverages are some of the best investments of all time.
Yeah.
Actually, part of my thesis is I read an investor, like, I didn't know Celsius from Adam. You know, obviously you start paying attention when stocks do a lot. You know, I think it's up 5,000% in the last 5 years or something crazy like that. But there was a money manager who was like 6-7 years ago, I forget who it was, who was like, huh, Celsius is 20% of the market share in this one state. Wow. And they're just focused on this one state. I wonder what would happen if they got that same market share everywhere else. And he just asked himself, why would it be different in any other state? And so, like, this is just one small example. And I know it's the end of the podcast, and I appreciate you having me on. There's so much opportunity in this industry by just following your curiosity, by doing basic due diligence and research, developing a view, and then just riding the wave. But you have to be comfortable with like crazy illiquidity. You got to be comfortable with shifting regulatory, political risk. But if you are, I think we're at the beginning of, like, you know, 20 plus years where something is just really exciting to be a part of. And there's just tremendous growth. Everything's easier when there's growth.
Yeah. Yeah. No, this is look, I mean, we're gonna have to come back and do one on the beverages once you start seeing some beverage IPOs or some companies that are, you know, public that have some of that in their pipeline.
That would be fun.
Aaron, this has been such a great conversation. I can't wait to release this. I know that those that enjoy capital cyclical industries or that enjoy hunting in bombed out spaces will love this podcast. I think it's going to help them get up to speed. You gave them a few ideas as well. If people want to learn more about you, learn more about your cannabis fund, where can they go to find out more information?
Well, I have a free newsletter, mindsetvalue.substack.com. You can also, I post.
This episode is brought to you by Ticker. Ticker.com is focused on bringing institutional level investment research to you, the individual investor. Ticker.com is powered by S&P Global Capital IQ and has coverage of over 50,000 stocks globally with financial data, estimates, valuation metrics, ownership percentages, transcript filings, news, and more. ValueHive listeners can join Ticker's free beta trial today at ticker.com/hive. That's TIKR.com/hive. Today's episode is also brought to you by Marhelm Data. Marhelm is an information service for investors to find real value in an overvalued market. With a focus on shipping and commodities, Marhelm helps you stay on the pulse of global trade, track global sentiment, and identify compelling global investment opportunities. ValueHive listeners can get 20% off a Marhelm Data subscription by using the code VALUE at checkout. That's VALUE at checkout. Head on over to marhelm.com, marhelm.com to get your discount today.